Okay, and in regards to last week, and emphasizing to see what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, I would like to share one verse from you from Ephesians chapter 1. I stressed that the truth concerning things that are not seen, things that are eternal, things of God, truth, is seen. That is an accurate analogy or metaphor of how we gain possession of the truth, is that we see it. And the Bible speaks in those terms in many ways. And I just want to point out one verse to you that is very clear, distinct, in saying this very same thing. And that's chapter 1, verse 18 of Ephesians. In Paul's prayer about the Ephesians, he says, "I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened, so that you may know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, and what is the surpassing greatness of his power towards us who believe." So Paul prayed that they would know these things as a result of the eyes of their heart being enlightened. So that is how he has pictured it over and over, that we come to know that which is true about God and the gospel by the eyes of our heart seeing the truth. That's how we come to know these things. In the same way, the scriptures talk about Satan has blinded the eyes of those who are in unbelief and that sort of thing. So the metaphor is throughout the scriptures, and this is one of the better verses to demonstrate that very concept. So if we're going to behold the manner of love that God has to us, it is going to be through the eyes of our heart. And we need God to enlighten the eyes of our heart, as Paul said. He would pray that the eyes of their heart would be enlightened. He didn't pray that the eyes of the heart would be open, because they were already open. Ephesians were those who had already been willing to see. But Paul prays that their eyes, which are open and willing to see, will be enlightened or gain greater light upon the subjects that he names. Great love of God, the power of God unto believers, and things like that. That would go along with the concept of growing in the grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that will be true throughout eternity, that the eyes that can perceive, the eyes of our heart, will have access to greater and greater light upon the things of God, upon his law, upon his character, upon his will, upon his administration of his kingdom. We will see with the eyes of our heart. Okay, any questions from last week? Any thoughts? Puzzles? Nothing that has provoked your thinking through the week after last Friday night? Okay. We're back in 1 John. We're approaching a particular passage in 1 John that is a very strong passage to some. That's a wonderful passage to others. The law of God, the Ten Commandments, is very threatening to the sinner and wonderful to the believer, to the saint. The sinner hears, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's property. Thou shalt not lie. Thou shalt not steal." All of those are threatenings to the sinner. To the saints, they're more like promises. To those who love God, they shall not covet their neighbor's property, and they shall not commit adultery, and they shall not lie, and they shall not steal, those who do love God. And looking on the other side of conversion and looking back to statements that terrorize the sinner are great words of comfort to the saint. So to one who does not trust God and does not love God, the notion of verse 6, no one who abides in Him sins, is very perplexing, exasperating. But to one who does love God and is born of God, it's a wonderful statement of reassurance. It's a confirmation of the consciousness that one has of their state before God. And they know that they love God. They're aware of the fact that they're not sinning against God. And this is a harmonious statement of the truth regarding that person and the state in which they're in. We're going to start tonight with verse 4. And we're going way back to the ABCs. Because if we're going to get to verse 6 and verse 9 and everything that's in between, and we say verse 9, no one who is born of God practices sin. Verse 6, no one who abides in Him sins. If we start and go right to those verses, we will go round and round in circles or with vagueness of ideas that we need not have, because we need to make some definitions and understandings first before we get into those scriptures. We need to surround them, come at them with understanding. So starting with verse 4. 1 John 3:4. Teresa, would you read that?
Everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness.
No, that's just that one verse for right now. Thank you. What is sin according to this verse? Excuse me?
Lawlessness.
Does anybody know what the King James translates this? Transgression of the law. Transgression of the law. Lawlessness. Does everyone see the similarity between the two? Would you take this and find lawless under there, Karen?
I was just going to, when you ask for similarity, are you referring to the fact the word law means similarity between both of them?
Not just that law is in the words, but the idea behind each one of them, the idea in each one of them. This might suggest that there is no law. Sin is the absence of law. Lawlessness. Okay. Would you read the definition of lawless?
Without law, not regulated by the authority of law, as a lawless city, contrary to law, illegal, unauthorized, as lawless practices, not obeying the law, unruly, disorderly.
Okay. So it is not just without law, but it is not law abiding in the face of an existing law. It is the refusal to acknowledge and adapt law for one's life. Now read lawlessness, Danny. It's one or two beneath that.
The quality or state of being unrestrained by law, disorder.
Okay. Lawlessness is a state of not being restrained by law. The law is there, but it is a state of being unrestrained by law. The riots in Los Angeles a year ago is a demonstration of when there is law, but people are not restrained by it. And a certain part of the city last year was in a state where law did not reign over people and did not constrain them. Nothing constrained them at that time. Transgression means to cross over. Here's the law. Transgression of the law is to cross over it, to break it, to violate it. So it's not constrained by the law. It doesn't come up to the law and it constrains itself by the law, but just goes right on through the law. Refuses to acknowledge the law and its authority. So it's the same thing translated into different words. That's what sin is. Sin is the transgression of law or not being restrained by law. Does that tell us very much yet? If we were to go to verse 6, no one who abides in him, what? Sins. What would that mean with this limited definition that we have? Verse 6. How would we make application with this? Teresa?
No one who abides in him transgresses the law.
No one transgresses the law. If you abide in God, no one that abides in God transgresses the law. Okay? Verse 9. No one who is born of God practices what? And? No one who is born of God practices lawlessness or without the restraint of law. One who is born of God is restrained by the law. Would be another way to put it, appropriately so. Okay? So we have a beginning of understanding here. Now, the law, I'm going to read to you something from 1 Timothy chapter 1. I'm going to read to you Paul's instructions to Timothy about some who have turned aside to fruitless discussions. Verse 6 and 7 of chapter 1. For some men straying from these things, which are in verse 5 mentioned, love from a pure heart, and a good conscience, and a sincere faith. He says, some men straying from these things have turned aside to fruitless discussions, wanting to be teachers of what?
The law.
Even though they do not understand either what they are saying or the matters about which they make confident assertions. We want to go beyond making confident assertions. We want to make sure that we understand what we are saying and what we are asserting. We just don't want to talk about the law. It is absolutely necessary that we grasp the concept of the law that is here referred to. I know that we've all gone through this in times past, but this is going to be a review, but a review I think is going to be timely and very worthwhile. So we're going back to the A's and the B's and the C's, and it is not going to be detrimental to us at all, but for our good. When Jesus came, those who were teachers of the law, like Nicodemus, did not understand the law. They adopted traditions. They went by the letter. They translated or interpreted it in such a way that they could have anger towards their brother without being guilty of murder. And Jesus corrected that thinking. They translated or interpreted the law in such a way that they could show their righteousness before men in the letter of the law. That's not the spirit of the law. And Jesus had to correct and says, you've been taught this, but I say to you. And the teachers of the law said, okay, love your neighbor, but it's okay to hate your enemy. They're your enemy. And Jesus said, it's been told you, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies. Jesus had to correct the people of Israel's ideas that they had received from the teachers of Israel. Because the teachers of Israel had lost the perception of the real spirit of the law. And that's what we must grasp, is the real spirit of the law. You must see its true character in its very many aspects to gain a true appreciation of it. Now, only by a proper understanding of the law can we have a proper understanding of sin. Only by that. People discuss sin all the time. The subject of whether or not a Christian has a sin comes up. The word sin is thrown around, but it has no depth of meaning to it because the law is not understood. What is being transgressed is not in view. When people are having these various discussions about sin and salvation and atonement, and all of that. People do not have in view in their minds a concept of sin based upon a true understanding of what has been transgressed. That is the law. So it's very, very important to us. Now, in this chapter, Psalms 19 that we went through, the law of the Lord is perfect. In that psalm, we have the psalmist declaring certain attributes attached to the law. It is perfect, it is sure, it is right, it is pure. We are to have the same attitude towards the law. We are to recognize that the law of God is pure, it is right, it is sure, it is perfect, it is true, it is righteous altogether. Romans 7:12. Romans 7:12. So then the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. Paul calls the law holy, righteous, good. The law does not cause sin. It is righteous. It is holy. It is good. The psalmist said it is perfect and sure and right and pure. The psalmist says that the law restores the soul. It makes wise. It rejoices the heart. It enlightens the eyes. Paul said in Galatians that the law is a tutor to lead us to Christ. Paul said in Galatians that it is not able to impart life. Paul said in Galatians that the law does not justify. Paul said in Romans chapter 3, verse 20, that the law gives a knowledge of sin. The law gives the knowledge of sin. No man ever attained knowledge of their sin without the law. There's no way to measure transgression without obtaining the idea of what the law commands. The idea of the law itself. There's no way to know. If you are a sinner, if you have transgressed the law of God without a knowledge and an idea of that law. By the law is the knowledge of sin. Romans 7:9, it says it slays the sinner. 7:13, it shows sin to be sin. What do we mean by the term law? What do we mean by the term law? Karen?
Loving the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength, and thy neighbor as thyself.
We know that that is the moral law, but that's a few steps beyond where I want to go. That is the definition of the moral law. What is law? Any law. Pat?
I think of sanction and obligation.
Okay, you think of sanction and obligation. Backing up even further than that. That's down around G or H or I. I'm back to A and B. I'm back to the primary. Danny? Okay. A law is a rule of action. Any law is a rule of how an action must be. Okay? It is applicable to every kind of action. every conceivable action of any kind if there is a law, then it applies to that action. Action of any kind. Rule of action. If there is to be action, there is a rule that governs it. That's a law. Okay. There are two kinds of law. As we go through this, let this develop and expand your understanding. Put some things in perspective. Rearrange them properly if they have slipped out of where they once were or your understanding. And see with me what we have here. There are two kinds of law. Two kinds of rules of action. Pat?
Bruce, go back to the prior thing first. The rule of action. Did you say that if there's any action, there's a rule that governs it? And that's law?
My point was to make that the rule of action of law covers any kind of action. It's not restricted to any particular kind of action.
Okay.
So if anything is under law, then that law restricts or puts a rule upon any action that it may be under. Okay. There are two kinds of law. These two kinds of law cover everything that exists. Do you know what they are? You know what one of them is? Karen? Moral law. Physical law. Okay. The physical law covers the rule, is a rule of action over what? Good. Keep going. Okay. No, that's not a possible definition. Because then we'll get to moral law and you say anything that's not physical and say, so that's not going to work. Good try, though. Okay. It is over everything that is matter or mind that is under a law of necessity. It governs, this rule, this law governs all mental states or actions that are not free. That is what is meant by a law of necessity. A law of necessity means that if A happens, B will necessarily happen. Cannot be avoided. If I drop something, it will fall under the necessary law of gravity. It will necessarily fall. It has no choice. It's not free to do otherwise than obey that law. That's the law of necessity. Okay? The material world in which we live in, every bit of it, lives under the law of necessity. It can do no other than it does. Is that not true? All of the material world that we live in can do nothing other than live according to the laws that God has put it under. Man has discovered those laws and the workings of those laws. Everything in this material world has no choice but to do what it is commanded to do. Okay? That's the physical law. Now, here is where our understanding becomes more important. There is also the physical law that has to do with certain states in the mind. States in which we have no control over. That's under physical law. There is no choice in the matter. Can you think of illustrations that would demonstrate or name certain states of the mind that come under physical law? Karen?
Feelings.
Feelings. Okay, that's true. Feelings, emotions,
desires.
Appetites, passions, all of those are not something that are free to be otherwise. They come and arrive and arise as a result of cause and effect. They necessarily happen when the right cause is there. The effect will necessarily occur. You do not determine when your appetite for food will arise. It necessarily arises. Your desire or appetite, if that would be the word, to sleep. Thirst. Those are under the physical law that the action or the appetite for food is controlled by a physical law. You cannot choose by a will otherwise to have that appetite. What other states of mind would come under physical law? What other actions in the mind are actions that are not free? That is, actions you cannot choose for them to be otherwise. Danny?
Like impairment, like a physical brain tumor or something?
Okay, that brain tumor is under material or physical. Matter. We are talking about non-material, but the mind. The mind and the brain are not the same thing. The mind uses the brain in its relationship to the physical world, but the mind is more than the brain. So what states of mind, besides the sensibilities, are under physical law? What actions of the mind, maybe I should use that. What actions of the mind, besides the sensibilities, come under a law, physical law, that you cannot control by an act of your will? Karen?
I don't know, conscience.
True. Your conscience works necessarily. Under given conditions, it will do certain things without your decision to make it do that. That's right. Conscience, good. Yeah?
I was going to say intellect only because I thought of thinking. That thinking just happens. I don't.
Intellect is another one. It's an involuntary activity of the mind. You are always thinking. People are always thinking. It is not something we decide to do. So the intellect and its actions are involuntary. They come under physical law. The state of the sensibilities come under physical law. They're involuntary. The workings of the conscience, the actions of the conscience. Self-consciousness is an involuntary state of the mind. You are aware of your own existence and the actions that are going on within your mind as an involuntary action in your mind. You are involuntarily aware of yourself. My goodness, what's possibly left that does not come under this physical law, this involuntary law of necessity that we have no choice in? Okay?
The will.
The will is that which is excluded from physical law. The rest of the workings of the mind come under the law of necessity or the physical law, by which they are not acts of the will, but they happen involuntarily. The cause is there, the effect will happen. Let me point out while we're here that the will has the ability to control what the intellect will think about. The will has the ability to turn the intellect towards an object to think on. Okay? The intellect is capable of being turned. The object of what it will think about can be determined by the will. But that the intellect will think is not determined by the will. It will always think. But the will can put an object before it to think about. So some people think, well, I decided not to think about that. No, you decided to think about something else. You didn't decide to think about it. You decided to put your attention on something else. You're always thinking.
So it's an improper terminology to use. I just thought about how I was talking to someone today, and I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm thinking." And there's the implication in there that.
Her feelings or desires or passions or whatever. She may be more be expressing what she is conscious of than what she decided to do.
But nonetheless,
the thinking that she was observing is an involuntary thing. It didn't just start up when the person decided to crank up their thinking and then crank it down. We do divert ourselves from considering what we're thinking and the thinking that we're doing by entertainment, diversion, indulgence. But nonetheless, the mind is always thinking. All right, that's physical law. It covers matter and many actions of the mind. The only action of the mind it does not cover is the will, the action of the will. The second type of law is what we already named, and that is the moral law. This is a rule of action strictly for the action or acts of the will. All other acts except acts of the will happen by a law of necessity. Depending upon the cause, will have certain effects. And there's no control over them. However, the will can choose this or another object. It has the liberty to take an action that is free from necessity. It is not required to choose A as opposed to B. It is not necessary that it will. It may be required to, in the moral sense. Be very careful with our words here. But it will not necessarily choose A. It has the liberty to refuse to choose A. So the moral law is that rule of action that governs the free exercise of the will. We call it moral because liberty is involved. Moral law is that rule of action, of moral action with sanctions. Somebody tell me what the word sanctions mean? Pat? Sanctions are penalties. That's only part of it. There's another half to sanctions. That's part of penalty. reward. All come under the term sanction. In fact, sanctions in the penalty sense is only a late development in my thinking, because all my life I heard the term sanction meaning to approve. Did they sanction that? Yeah, they said I could do it. That's how I learned sanction. Lately, in the last 10 years, I should say, I've learned that sanction, especially in between governments, is when you put a penalty upon another government, like they did with Iraq, like they're doing with Bosnia. They're restricting them. They're penalizing them for their actions. But also includes rewards. So under moral law, there is rewards for conformity to a law and penalties for nonconformity to the law. Okay? So, moral law is that rule of action of the acts of the will. It is that rule that is to govern the acts of the will that determines or sets a requirement upon the will to make certain decisions. Do you have a grasp on that? Okay. All I've done is make a distinction between two kinds of law. One is physical law, whereby under that law everything happens by a law of necessity. Stones will always be stones. Animals will always do things by instinct. Things that are within us that are instinctual, we will always do them. Our instincts are under a physical law. We will always instinctively have certain reactions or certain responses, certain feelings under certain circumstances, certain desires under other circumstances. Those are all instinctive under a physical law. The workings of our intellect in thinking, our conscience in affirming truth and convicting ourselves, self-consciousness, all those are actions under physical law, law of necessity. The moral law does not address any of those actions. So nobody is ever guilty and deserving a penalty for anything that comes under a physical law. Why? Danny? Because it's involuntary. There's no wickedness nor virtue in obeying physical law, because the person had no choice but to do so. They didn't do them because they chose to. They did them because they had to. Under the moral law, it's where there is penalties and rewards, because the person had the freedom to obey or not obey. And it is only this will that is addressed in the moral law. Okay? Anybody want to expand or develop any of these thoughts while we're here at this stage? Distinction between the two laws. Okay. For your note, for your notice, under a very broad umbrella, but it is the identification mark to help us identify a certain school of thinking. The Calvinistic view of theology has only a view of physical law. They do not acknowledge moral law. They do not acknowledge the freedom of the will. They acknowledge that the will is under the necessity of choices presented to it, and it can do no other. So God's government is a physical government, according to them. And we live under laws of necessity where we can do no other than we do. Unless God steps in and gives us the ability to do something we didn't have the ability to do before. That's their view of redemption. Man is unable to obey any law that God has laid down, and will not until God gives him the ability to obey, and it is his inability to obey, regardless of it as inability, God still holds him as a sinner. They only have a physical law and a government of God under... In fact, they don't have a government of God. God rules by law, a physical law of necessity. Man does not have a free will. Very important distinction. Okay. Do you know the difference between attributes and conditions? If you were thinking about a school for your children, and I say to you, what are the attributes of a good school for your children? Name some for them.
One that teaches values.
One that teaches values.
Small classes.
Small classes.
Fully teachers.
Nearby, clean.
Good transportation.
Those are at
affordable.
No smoking. Those are attributes of a good school in our minds as we develop this. Those are attributes. Now, what would be the conditions in which we could create a good school?
Have land.
Until we met the condition to get enough money, we couldn't have the school. Until we got land, we couldn't have the school. Until we got teachers that could teach value, we couldn't have the good school. Until we had people agree to no smoking, we couldn't have a good school. Until we had good transportation, we couldn't have a good school. So we could name the things that we believe would be attributes of a good school, but those could never be unless certain conditions existed to be able for these things to be. True? See that? There's a difference between the two. Okay. We are now going to talk about the attributes of moral law. Things that we are going to name about moral law that is true about moral law. First is, it is subjective. We are developing in our reason, in our intellect, the idea. We are filling this idea of moral law with certain attributes. So as we expand our idea with these various attributes, we will get a fuller picture of what the moral law consists of. Okay? Then we can grasp more fully, more completely, what sin is when we understand what has been transgressed in our developed view of the law. Okay? First, it is subjective. That is, moral law is subjective in that it must, that does lie as an idea in the reason, in our intellect, in our reason. The idea of the moral law must be there. Okay? It's one of the necessary attributes. If there is no idea of this moral law or rule of action in the intellect, that person is not a moral agent. If there's no idea of moral obligation or law, that person is not a moral agent. It is the law that lies as an idea in the reason. It is the only place that the moral agent can refer to see his obligation. I can tell you about the moral law, but until it conceives itself as an idea within your mind, so that you see the moral law and what it demands, until that happens, it's not an obligation upon you. And until that happens, you're not obligated to obey it. That is the only place a moral agent has to go to observe the moral law. If it's not developed within his reason, it's outside of him, and he has no concept of it, it's like it's a tree halfway around the world. It has no relationship to him. So that what we are doing tonight is to develop within our reason the idea of the moral law. That by which, when we develop it, we can refer to it within us. And we will find its obligation put upon us, and we will have reference as to the rule of action for our will. Now let me say in passing, Pat.
Are you suggesting that the moral law has to be instructed to one?
No. It has to be an idea developed in the reason.
Okay, but the word develop implies, to me anyways, it implies instruction.
Well, instruction in the general sense of being instructed by observation of the own, of the person himself, rather than a classroom situation, I would call it instruction. Mm-hmm. But not necessarily a classroom situation with a teacher and a student.
I guess it comes across sometimes as a person is not a moral agent and has not transgressed the moral law until somebody has sat down with him and said, do you know you have an obligation to love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself? And he goes, oh. And then from then on they become moral agents. Where that's how it comes across, but that's not true.
No, I'm not trying to put a time frame on it or an experience place. I'm trying to say in principle, unless the idea is within the person's mind, however true and powerful and necessary that law exists anywhere else, until the person's mind perceives it, they have no obligation to obey it. It must be, it's an attribute of moral law that it be perceived in one's mind, for it to be imposed upon oneself. However that idea gets there. It must eventually be there. Danny?
I'm confused too. I don't really understand. I think back and I never really understood, knew really the moral law until I talked to you and Pat. Now I believe I was just as accountable before I met with you, but no one had ever taken the time to develop it in my mind, and I never saw that on my own. So was I accountable, or are people right now that have no development of the moral law in their mind, are they going to be able to say on Judgment Day, God, I do not the moral law or understand it?
Okay, let's back away from these specifics and understand the principle of it. If a moral being in its mind has no perception or idea of the moral law, he is under no obligation. Let us detach ourselves from our experiences and our past and ideas and just view this in principle. If there is a moral agent somewhere in the universe and he has never perceived the moral law in any sense, he is not under its obligation. There is no obligation where there is no knowledge of the law. It's a corollary to what I just said. The point of this idea is, one of the attributes of the moral law is, it must be an internal perception as well as a command externally from God. God can command it, but if I do not have any perception of it, regardless of the means, the point of that is I am not under obligation to obey it.
If you have no knowledge of it.
If I have no knowledge of it.
Okay, that makes sense. If you have no knowledge to obey, you have no obligation to obey something, you have no knowledge of it.
Same idea.
Okay.
Knowledge is having an idea of something. So if there's no idea of it, no knowledge of it, then I'm not obligated to obey it. Just as we went through child training. If your children have no knowledge of a requirement you have of them from you, you cannot hold them responsible for disobeying it because they had no knowledge of it. It's not disobedience if they had no knowledge of it. Remember those discussions? Okay. Now, these other things will come to light as we discuss this. But in a very narrow sense, knowledge is necessary for there to be moral law obligation upon oneself. Secondly, moral law as an attribute is it's objective. It's not just within me, but it exists as a command of God. Okay? So it's not just each man as an island to himself, and that is totally where moral law exists. But it also is commanded by God. It's also objective from any moral agent. Okay? So you see the contrast there that I'm making? It's external to self. Just like Jesus prayed, "Not my will, but thine be done." That's an acknowledgement that there was a will outside of Jesus himself to which he was submitted to. And so we are to be the same. An attribute of moral law is liberty. It's objective, as we just said. It's a command of God. Liberty. It must be an action that is free, not forced. That's an attribute of moral law. It commands an action that is to be free by the moral being, by the will, not forced upon the will. Okay? Understand that. Cannot be forced. God cannot force a sinner to be converted and conformed to the moral law. If he did, he would not be conforming to the moral law, because the moral law requires a free choice in the will to conform. So God would take away one's moral accountability if he forced the conversion of a sinner to conform to the moral law. God must stand back, and though he commands it, he must see that the choice is freely made by the will. That's an attribute of moral law. Fitness. The moral law is fit, proper fitness to our natures. It is just properly suitable to our natures and relations. It is the most natural law that could be imposed upon us as moral beings. It is not contrary to our natures, but in exact conformity to our natures and relationships. It is the law, the moral law commands that which would provide the greatest harmony if all moral beings were in conformity to it. Have you ever heard of natural law, the theory of natural law? You may have heard it when Clarence Thomas was defending himself. And some of the questioners were, "Well, do you believe in the theory of natural law? If you're going to sit as a judge on the bench, are you going to use the theory of natural law to make some of your judgments upon?" And he says, "I believe in natural law in this respect, but not in that respect." Well, the idea of natural law is that any law that is an obligation on anybody cannot be contrary to the nature of the person that law is imposed upon. So no law can demand something of you or me that is contrary to our nature. It cannot command us to fly. Cannot command us to see through walls. Okay? Cannot command us to feel certain things, desire certain things, not to think, not to have a conscience, all the things that we have no control over. No law can be moral law and command that they be different than our natures ordinarily work. So God's moral law, the moral law, does not command us to be different in our natures under that which is under physical law. The only thing moral law commands to change is the will's choice. That's what the law is addressing. So it doesn't address things in our nature that are under physical law. It only addresses things that can change, and that is the will. It is universal. An attribute of moral law is that it is universal. It applies to, and it makes its requirements upon, all moral agents. It requires the same thing wherever they may be, in whatever world they may be, at whatever time they may live. It is universal. The law that Lucifer, Satan, violated is the same law that you and I have imposed upon us. They were not under a different law. We know that because Satan fell or sinned, that must be a violation of moral law and must have involved a choice. So he violated moral law, not physical law. We know that and this is an interesting thing, the moral law existed before Moses gave it, before the world was made, because angels violated the moral law and sinned, so the moral law must have been enforced before the world was even made, when the angel sinned. So the moral law is not something that God just pronounced at the time of Moses on Sinai, or through Noah, or to Adam. But it has always existed, and we will see why. It's universal. It is impartial. Where there is moral law, it is impartial. It is no respecter of persons. It knows no privileged classes. None. The only thing that it does distinguish is if there is a moral agent there or not. If there is, it requires the same thing of all moral agents, no respecter of persons. It does not intend that the same course of action, conduct be taken, but that same state of heart be chosen by the will. But there's no respecter of persons. Practicability. Practicability. The moral law can only command that which is possible. And here is where something comes in that we've already discussed, and that is when it is not possible, when there is no ability, when there's no possibility, when there's no ability to follow that rule of action or law, then it is not law. If it's not possible to practice the law, it is not law. How does that apply? Let's apply these things to our thinking. If it's not possible to have desires on command, feelings on command, or the absences of on command, would it be moral law to be commanded to feel differently or think or desire differently? No, it would not be moral law to be commanded to do that which is not possible. Independence. Independence. It's another attribute of moral law. Independence. And this is really a significant and a beautiful attribute. By independence is meant that no moral law is ever an expression of the arbitrary will of another. Moral law is independent of anyone's arbitrary will. And we develop this part of this. This is significant. And here a very significant question arises. Is something right because God wills it, or does God will it because it's right? This is where this question arises. Is the moral law because God wills it, or does He will it because it's a law? Does the moral law exist independent of the will of God, or does it come into existence when He wills it? In our studies in child training, did we learn that you are to command something only when you have perceived it's good for your children? Or are you free to command something simply because you want to? Remember? There must lie within your reason, your understanding, a good that you have in mind when you command them something, so that you bring about that good. You're not free to command simply what you want without in view of whether it's good for them. In a very similar way, God has not made the moral law come into existence simply because He willed that there be this moral law. It's not an expression of His arbitrary will. If that were the case, God could have willed that all of us be selfish, and that would be an obligation upon all of us. That's true. If it is grounded upon His arbitrary will, He could have willed that we all take our lives when we turn 25, and we would be obligated to. If His arbitrary will is the basis of moral law, He could have commanded anything, and we would be obligated to do it, and we would transgress His law if we didn't do it. Then where did the law come from? The law, the moral law, has always existed. God's attributes, His natural attributes, consist in infinite knowledge, infinite wisdom, infinite reason. Okay? His infinite wisdom and reason perceives as He has. Let me try to demonstrate it in a very primitive manner. Let's imagine God at the beginning, though He had no beginning. But let's imagine at some point, so our mind can conceive of this. At some point of God's beginning, He, in His reason, which has every conceivable thought that He could think, that could be thought, He is thinking of them at one time. His reason perceives that there is one and only one rule of action for moral beings that would produce the greatest good in the universe. And that rule of action is not to seek one's own good first. In fact, this is the end of side one. Side two now begins. His reason determined what moral law would be. His reason perceived what law would produce the highest state of blessedness, and imposed upon himself the necessity to live according to that, or if he did not, he himself would be a transgression of moral law. To put it simply, God commanded that we love Him supremely and our neighbor as ourselves, because His reason tells him That is the greatest and highest law for all moral agents. It is not his arbitrary will speaking, but it is infinite wisdom speaking in the moral law. James talks about that wisdom that comes down from heaven. That's the spirit of the moral law. The moral law is an expression of infinite wisdom. Of all possible alternatives of ways for moral agents to live with one another, this is the highest and best way for us to relate to each other, for moral agents to have relationships. And he made it, it is a law within his reason, and he so imposed it upon us because we are moral agents as he is. So it is independent of anyone's will. It is an idea of the reason, not simply someone's will. It is immutable. Immutable. Unchangeable. It cannot be changed. It can never be changed. Moral law can never, never change. We understand by the moral law the command to love God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength, love my neighbor as myself. Let us suppose a case. Let us suppose that I love God with all my heart, love my neighbor as myself, and my capacity to love God increases. Do I now love God and fulfill the moral law more than what the law commands? No. Teresa, why not?
Because you're just doing it with all the ability that you have. So if you have a greater ability, you get a different point than if you say.
You don't do more than the law requires. You simply. Your capacities expand, your commitment fills those capacities, and you're simply doing, once again, the same standard. All. That's the spirit of the law. All. Now, let's suppose a person's capabilities are greatly diminished. Are they now in violation of the law? If this is their capacity to love God and their neighbor, instead of this is all gone. Are they now in violation of the law because they now have less capacity than they had before? No, and for the same reason. Because if this is devoted to all as before, then it is a fulfillment of the law. So the law doesn't change even though moral capacities can change. Because what the law addresses is totality, all, total consecration, not degrees. Another attribute of moral law is unity. Can somebody express what that refers to? Guy?
Becoming one with God. His will.
Okay. In a sense. And somebody else want to express it another way? Danny?
Just like there's not, if your heart is committed to that end, then it's committed to that end in all things.
Mm-hmm.
Not certain areas, yes, and certain areas, no.
Okay.
Supreme.
There's only one end, only one ultimate intention, as opposed to the idea that you can serve two masters. You can only serve one. Moral law is a unity. It commands one undivided end. Cannot be divided between other ends. What it commands as a rule of action is one united action towards one end. Moral law is expedient. Do you know what expedient means? Pat?
Efficient.
Efficient is pretty close. You ever heard of expediting something? You're going to expedite that? Speed it up. Make it as direct as possible. No obstacles in the way. You're going to expedite something, you're just going to cut out every possible obstacle so that nothing hinders going from here to there. The moral law is the law of expediency. You don't just do those things that you could possibly do, but you only decide to do those things that would be the most expeditious in seeing the end accomplished. Paul says, all things are lawful, but not all things are expedient. The moral law puts us under the law of expediency to only do those things that will most quickly bring about the end in view without obstacles and not simply just do everything that we might possibly do that's not prohibited. Okay? Expediency is part of the moral law. And exclusiveness. Last attribute is exclusiveness. Some of these overlap in our discussions. Exclusiveness means that there's no other possible rule of action. That what the moral law commands excludes all other possibilities of obligation upon a person. That is what is required and excludes any other obligations. In application, what the moral law commands you and I, if we are conformed to that, requires that whatever other demands other people may put upon us or we may put upon ourselves, we would exclude those demands and laws if it is not in conformity to what the moral law commands. It's exclusive. It's the only law permitted. Okay. Now, what kind of ideas have enlarged in your mind regarding the moral law tonight? What new, if any, or expanded notions of the moral law have you seen in our discussion tonight? Has abruptly caught you up to see something new, if anything. Pat?
I see that in transgressing it, I transgress much more than just a command, much more than just something that's subjective. I transgress something that's subjective. I just was seeing all that makes up the law, and I transgress it as a whole. I transgress more than just an objective command of God.
Okay. More than just His arbitrary will, but something broader than that, and more meaningful than just the wish of a large person, but something that it, listen, that the law, the moral law, would exist if God did not. Because there are moral agents that exist, if moral agents could exist and there were no God, the moral law would exist even if God did not. It is independent of God's existence or will. It exists where there are moral agents and their relationships. We've discussed this before, you may recall. In fact, the moral law and what it commands, commands it even if God were to command something else. God's God's arbitrary will, if he were to command us to be selfish, would not be moral law to us. The moral law is independent of his arbitrary will. He, in fact, commands it because God is conformed to what his reason knows is law upon moral beings. His reason knows, sees what is the law of moral beings, and he has conformed himself to it. What does that tell you about God? That he's not selfish. That he's benevolent. We haven't even expressed the moral law to any development here. These are some of the attributes of it as law. But it tells us that what would be the state of God's will if he has conformed himself to the moral law? If God has conformed himself to the moral law, he has chosen to obey the law, to be in a state of benevolence, to seek the highest good of being wherever it may exist. The law of the Lord is perfect. It is right. It is pure. It is sure. Why? Because what he commands is based on his infinite reason and wisdom, not just his whims and fancies at some point in eternity. The moral law is an eternal fact. It's an eternal law because God is eternal. It exists where moral agents and their relations exist. Wherever those two things exist, there is a law that is imposed upon moral beings. As I illustrated before, here we have a farm in Kansas. Remember this guy living in this house? There he lives all by himself, all his life. Remember this? Karen remembers this. Lives there all his life. Has never seen and does not know of any other human being that exists. I'm making this up, obviously. He has no moral obligation. He is under no moral law. Why? Why would he be under no moral law? Guy?
There's no other moral agent that he's aware of that he has to conform his will to.
Relate to.
Relate to.
Relate to. It's have. Wait a minute, honey. I'm supposing a case. I'm supposing a case. A case of a man who grew up all his life never knowing there's another moral agent. Just follow my case. The point is, he has no knowledge that there are any other moral agents alive, therefore he has no relationship to anyone. It is the existence of moral agents and their relationship that impose upon them to decide how they will live with each other, what they will intend towards each other. So, in my example, this guy lived all his life without knowing that there's any other moral agent. Then, when he's about 40 years old, this guy moves in next door. He's a moral agent. What does that impose upon him? He is faced with knowing he has to relate to this other moral agent some way, and he has a will which he must choose, either to look out for his interests or only his own. The existence of the other moral agent and a relationship between them forces and imposes upon him that he must choose what he will intend towards his neighbor. Do you see that? It's not that he decides arbitrarily, well, I'm going to be good to my neighbor. The fact that he is there imposes upon him, and it's his reason, as he sees and thinks about this neighbor, his own reason concludes he is now under obligation to do something about that neighbor. He is forced with a choice. One object that he is to choose is to seek his neighbor's good as his own. The other choice is, nuts on that guy, I'm only going to seek my own. The fact that they're there and they have a relationship forces those two choices. Teresa?
I understand all that, but I don't understand why you said that the moral law would still exist even if God did not exist. Would it exist just because it's good?
I said if there were moral agents but no God.
Yeah,
this case here, if there were no God here, and they were just farmers in Kansas, the moral law exists because he has reason. He sees other moral agents. His reason affirms that he has two choices. His reason puts before him two choices. Either to seek his good as if it were his own, or to seek his own good supremely. Whether God exists or not, he's faced with that choice. His reason affirms to him that it is a good to seek his neighbor's good as his own, and something to condemn himself for if he remains selfish. His conscience will affirm that he is guilt-worthy if he does not seek his neighbor's interest as his own. And his reason enlightens him to see he has an obligation to seek his neighbor's interest as his own. Do you see that as law? Okay. The reason perceives an obligation upon himself to do something other than be selfish. Okay? The same thing with God. God's reason, infinite, perceived that he has an obligation to be benevolent towards others and not be self-centered. It comes from God's reason and not just his arbitrary will. But he wills it because his reason affirms and perceives this law that's imposed upon himself. Does that answer your question? Okay. The moral law is nothing more than reason's perception of other moral agents and having a relation. Once those conditions are met, one's own reason affirms that there's an obligation to treat them according to benevolence and not be selfish in those conditions. Danny?
I thought in Charleston when you said in order to have a government you needed to have a governor, in order to have law established there needed to be someone establish that law. I thought there needed to be a governor in order to have law. And in that sense, I'm thinking that were the case, then I too wondered how to do moral law without a God. And I'm thinking if that's the case, that the moral law exists without a God, then why would anyone need the moral law to be developed in their mind?
Okay, I don't say that the moral law exists without God. I said if there were moral agents and no God, as an if case. The moral law exists because there are moral agents, not because there's God.
How do they know about the law? Did that moral law exist? Because I thought you said it needed to be developed.
Before there can be obligation, the idea of law must be developed. This man had no idea of moral obligation because he had no idea of another moral agent or that he had a relationship with him. I'm talking about conditions before. Okay? The conditions for moral law is moral agents and relations. Where those two conditions do not exist, there is no moral law. Now, this man, a moral agent, and no relationship with moral agents, had no law imposed upon him. No idea. He could have no idea of an obligation towards other moral agents because he had no idea that there was any. See that? Okay. Once another moral agent settles down within his view, now the idea of other moral agent and a relationship to him goes into his mind by the very fact that he sees another moral agent. That develops the idea within him that there is another moral agent and he has a responsibility to relate to him in one way or another. That very perception of another moral agent is part of the development of the idea that he has an obligation to do something towards him. Ignore him or love him, whatever. You see that? Okay.
That same thing goes for the food that the man found outside his cave, that he knew that some other moral agent brought that food.
Very similar idea.
So he didn't see another moral agent, but he knew it just didn't come there every day, so he was under obligation.
He saw something that was undeniably connected with the fact that there had to be another moral agent to have brought that food. It could just not have happened accidentally or through the laws, physical laws of necessity. Somebody, some moral agent with will, brought that. Right, same idea. Within that cave dweller's reason, when he saw the food brought, that imposed upon him the development of the idea that there were other moral agents. And that imposed upon him the necessity to have a relationship with those moral agents, even if he didn't know who they were. It was imposed upon him that he had a relationship with them, that he had to act one way or the other. Be ungrateful and ignore them, or go find them. The development of the idea of obligation is much more basic than we generally think in terms of. Pat?
My question too goes along with Damien and Teresa's, and that is that with the statement that the moral law would exist even if God didn't, that in my understanding, unless there's sanctions attached to a rule, it is not law, it is merely advice. And as she said, without a governor, without one to implement those sanctions, penalties or rewards, then it's not law. It's merely advice. It merely be a good thing to do in our mind, but it really would necessarily be law. So in that sense, I don't understand how, apart from there being a being greater than us that we owe our allegiance to and have an obligation to, how could we be under moral law?
Follow my supposition. It's only a supposition to clarify the grounds for moral law. The grounds for moral law is not that God exists, but that moral agents and their relations exist. That's the grounds for moral law. Now, moral law has sanctions, penalties, and rewards. Where do these sanctions come from in this case? This man's conscience would either sanction him with penalties of guilt or rewards of praise. He would, as Paul says, he would be a... Yes, because as Paul says, that the Gentile becomes a law unto himself, either excusing or accusing himself in his conscience. Okay? So, we could all testify to that. That under moral obligation, we do experience our own sanctions. If we were under a governmental structure, they would be required to establish sanctions, which our own consciences would affirm would be just, because we do it to ourselves. So it's based upon the sanctions of our own conscience.
Okay.
This is really important to understand, that the moral law exists because of these two conditions, and not simply because God arbitrarily willed. Love me and love me most, and love your neighbor as yourself, because I want you to. He willed it because is the reason's highest understanding of what relations between moral beings ought to be. And he, God, has conformed himself to live in a way in which he will produce the highest and best relationships with other moral beings, at least from what he intends to produce. Now, his conformity to this law of his reason that tells him what moral agents are to live by, what law they're to live by, is the reason why he created the earth, is the reason why he created man, and is the reason why he sent Jesus to make an atonement for sin. To produce the highest good to the universe, the creation of the world and the creation of man and the atonement of Christ are means to that end. The creation of the world and the creation of man and the atonement of Christ are the expressions of the benevolent disposition of God, who is moved by and lives by this devotion to the highest good of the universe. Now, I said, and this to me is a very wonderful thing, I said, and I shared this before, to bring it back to your remembrance, I said that the basis of moral law is the existence of moral agents and their relations. Did the moral law, under those conditions, did the moral law exist before there was man, moral agents? Did the moral law exist before there was angels, moral agents? Mm-hmm. Why?
Want me to answer that?
Okay.
Because of the Godhead.
By that you mean?
The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit all had to interact with one another.
They had relations.
They're
moral beings. They were therefore under obligation to decide, to perceive, and then to decide how their relations were going to be. And they conformed themselves each to seek the greatest and highest good of one another.
So there's complete unity in the Godhead.
Complete harmony. They are all seeking the good of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, let us make man in our image.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the moral law exists, because there's moral agents and they have a relationship eternally. But not from their will, but it is their reason that understands that seeking each other's good instead of their own is what they're obligated to do. They have a choice: seek the good of each other or seek their own supremely. Their reason tells them that's their two choices, and they have devoted themselves, he has devoted himself, however we say it, to the choice to seek the good of others instead of just their own. Okay, you can think about that. That's the basis of moral law. That's the ground of moral law, is that there are moral agents who have a choice of how they're going to relate, and that they do have relations. Those two conditions being fulfilled, there is moral law existing. It comes into existence when those two conditions are met. Necessarily brings those two into existence. Okay? Anyone else want to express any new thoughts or stimulation of thinking or expansion of thinking from our discussion so far? Pat?
Well, I just want to say that in the beginning, when I was difficult in my understanding with you saying that the idea of the moral law had to be developed, and it sounded as if you had to, you know, be someone with a reasonable amount of intelligence and sit in some type of classroom structure. The more we talk about it, the more I realize that from infancy, when there's perception, the idea of moral agent, of moral obligation is being developed in being by parents and those around them. Don't hit your brother. You know, don't throw your food. All that is, I saw that all that is protection of obligations being put upon others because of their relationships with each other. Don't do this to another person.
Just because they're there.
Just because they're there. So it's not something when you're a teenager and you need to sit down and learn from infancy. The idea of moral obligation is being developed in us, to people.
That, in an expanded form, is what Paul means in Romans 1 when he says that all are guilty because, regardless of whether they're Jews or Gentiles, the Gentiles, even though they didn't have the law, through what could be seen in God's creation, are held accountable because what they can see in creation so strongly implies that there is another. So strongly implies that there is a God who's a creator, that very perception that there is a creator imposes upon them their necessity to relate to Him. That is the development of the idea of moral obligation. The very perception that there is a God imposes the necessity to decide, will you or will you not relate to a creator? So like the childhood thing, the Gentiles from thousands of years, hundreds and thousands of years, have never been without this development of this idea. Teresa?
I was in a meeting about this article I read. Church, and I don't know how old the kids were, but he was so shocked when the little girl, I don't know how old she was, did come up with ideas about someone, about God, but he does not know where they came from. And I just thought it was interesting because I believe it was her own mind, or her, and I thought because she had no, because we've talked about that before, where does that idea come from? Yeah, obviously she had it somewhere in here.
Paul says that the Gentiles are without excuse because they have the witness of creation that sufficiently imposes upon them an obligation that when they suppress the truth of this revelation in unrighteousness, they are guilty before God. Okay, we look at Romans 1 and it's very much comes and in line with what we've been talking about. The Gentiles who have never heard of the law, never heard of anything about the Jews or Jehovah or the promises, never had a law. The question is, well, are they guilty? And Paul answers that by saying, yes. They, through creation, have a sufficient witness from God to impose upon them an idea that they owe God at some kind of relationship, that when they suppress this truth, Romans 1:18, in unrighteousness, they are guilty, and sufficiently guilty, for violating the amount of light that they see. The question is not, did they see all of the law of Moses and the moral law? No. The question is, did they see some kind of law, a moral obligation, deposited within their reason, some idea developed within their reason that when they rejected that, they were rejecting the light that they did have? Point number one, it's subjective. Moral law, one of its attributes is it's developed within the reason. Paul says in Romans 1 that in the reason of the Gentiles, a sufficient idea was developed about God that put them under obligation to seek God. But they suppress that truth, therefore they are guilty of the idea of light and law that they did have. They didn't have this much development, but what was developed, they rejected. See that? So God does not require that man know all of the moral law and all the 12 attributes and things we're talking about tonight. What God does require is whatever idea of obligation that is developed in someone's reason, that they accept that and submit to that, not reject it. You talk to people about God, and they say, I don't know, maybe he does. That very maybe puts them under obligation to clear that up. To find out for sure, yes or no. But the very, well, maybe he does, is an obligation to do one or the other. It's an acknowledgement that they have a suspicion that God exists. If that is possible that he exists, then to reject that possibility is the willingness to deny him altogether, even if they're not sure. Okay? Anything else? Danny?
So much more, and the moral law is just one thing. And I know in the past I've really repented of a lot of things that are physical law, and I didn't really have a clear understanding what sin was.
It is commonly presented some. Things that are under physical law are commonly presented as moral law. It is commonly presented that we are under obligation to certain things that we cannot be under obligation to. And they go under physical law. The biggest mistake and error in this regard is that it is presented that we are under moral obligation to have certain feelings or desires. Those come under physical law. What God requires is we do not obey them. Not that we don't have them, but we do not obey them.
It seems like that's where the simplicity comes in, because I know I've used to think that I wouldn't desire something or feel a certain way, because once I was truly converted, I wouldn't have this kind of desire or feeling anymore. I really and truly believe that.
What's to understand? What is the narrow object of the moral law? And it is strictly the will. God is after the sinner's consent, not after his feelings and desires and passions and the workings of his intellect or his conscience. Is after his consent, because this is all that the sinner has control of. This is all that he is free. This is all the moral law addresses, because that's all that can be free. This is where sin lies, is in the refusal to love God. This is where sin lies, is the unwillingness to love God.
The idea of love is all wrapped up in the
sensibility. Oh yes, that's another subject.
And to accept the command of how to love God, from necessity, one would think it imposes obligation to feel a certain way then, because then that would mean I love God.
That's another term that needs to be developed, love, what that means. But what God is after is the willingness to love Him. The willingness to obey Him. The willingness to submit to Him. It's the willingness. The willingness is where virtue lies. That's why the atonement was so virtuous. Because Christ was willing to sacrifice Himself. Didn't have to. This is voluntary, self-sacrificial death. It was such a virtuous thing to the atonement. He was not under necessity, a law of necessity, that he could do no other. So the moral law addresses, strictly speaking, the will. The Bible often talks about having certain state of desires or feelings. Those are expressed in terms of results of the state of the will. Not something directly. Indirectly. Not something directly. That will happen. But the moral law does not command them to happen. The moral law commands this. Jenny?
No, when I was thinking about 1 Corinthians 13, when you think about love being patient, so if my will is committed to love God, in the past I would struggle if I saw an impatient, like a feeling or something inside, if I knew that I was beginning to, you know, it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, but not even outwardly acting it out, but I knew that inside I was very frustrated, and to me, feeling impatient. And so that, to me, I mean, I guess unless I outwardly acted by the will, I chose to act impatiently outwardly with the kids, then that wasn't sin. If I had impatience, but I thought if it's in your heart, then that's what I think love is patient. Okay, well, I didn't do anything outwardly, but I knew what I felt like inside.
Let me hold off on developing that, Danny, because that's getting into the whole area of what love is. Okay, let me pose it to you in this way. This is what the law commands, the moral law. Love supremely to God, to my neighbor as if he were myself. What that means needs as much development in the reason as what we just went through tonight about the law. The sensibilities never can develop the idea of what love is. Ideas are developed in the reason. To know whether or not you love God, you must develop in your reason the idea of love. Then you can know what it is you would commit yourself to. Okay? Love would be the commitment to conform to the moral law would be to commit the will to what the reason understands as loving God supremely. Not what the sensibilities feel like it is or desire it to be, but until the idea of loving God supremely and your neighbor as yourself is developed in your reason, so that you know what it is you're commanded to do, what are you choosing? See? We know we have an obligation to our neighbor. Some kind. A guy moves in next door and we know I've either got to treat him one way or the other. But what does that one way mean? Understand, this is the narrow target for the moral law. This is the only thing the moral law addresses. Everything else is under physical law. Cannot be commanded to be other than it is. And what the will can do is choose an end. It's free to choose an end. An intent. And what the law commands is this end instead of this end. All of the moral activity of a moral agent happens right there. What will a person choose as the end for which they live? Everything else is under physical law. It's going to happen because it's going to happen. Except the end for which you and I will live. Now, the sinner has transgressed or crossed over what the law commands and has gone his own way, seeking his own. All we like sheep have gone astray. There's none righteous, no, not one. No one seeks after God. Why? Because the sinner has transgressed the law and chosen as his end, whatever his feelings or desires or passions, appetites cry out for. That is his reference point for his end. This is only two ends it's only two ends we can choose. Self supremely, or what love would demand. The sinner, God says, has transgressed the law, does not restrain himself according to what the law commands, but lawlessly indulges every whim, feeling, desire, passion, appetite. Without regard to reason, it's an unreasonable life. Without regard to an idea and the reason, but just what the desires cry out for. Now, let me just tie something together. John says, everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is no restraints on by the law, but an unrestrained indulgence and obedience to the feelings and desires. John also says, no one who abides in him sins. No one who abides in him crosses over the restraints that the law puts upon an individual. What he is saying is, when a person abides in Christ, that is a consequence of being born again. Talked about being called children of God because we have been born of Him. We have been made one with Christ. We have been put into Christ. John says, let that abide in you which you heard from the beginning. If what you heard from the beginning abides in you, you also will abide in the Son and in the Father. If you, what you have received and heard from the beginning, never leaves you, but you always take it in, keep taking it in, and hold on to it, and live according to it, he says that's what it means to abide in Christ. Well, that case is, as Christ comes and brings the gospel to a person and reveals what God's will is for the person, that person who never rejects what he has heard of the gospel from the beginning is one who has developed the idea of his obligation and has consented to live according to this idea and has repented of living according to his sensibility. In such a case, that person now abides in Christ, being constrained by the will of God as he understands it because he has consented to live according to that end, and he no longer indulges his feelings and desires and sensibilities. It is impossible to live according to the truth and sin. That's what John is saying in 3:6. No one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. To know him, to see him, to take in everything we learn of him and never reject it, is to abide in him. Nobody can hear of Christ, hear of the law, hear of the gospel, take it all in, never reject light. Nobody can remain in sin and still not reject light. It's impossible to be a person who hears all the truth that you hear, not rejecting any of it, conforming to all that you hear, and remain in sin. It's an impossibility. Because the law comes to you and says, this is the will of God for you. And Christ comes and says, I have atoned for your sin. And the Father comes and says, I will be merciful and gracious to you. And when you receive all of that truth, what do? You receive His mercy and grace. You consent to obey what He has commanded because it is right. It is good. It is His will. So receiving all of this truth, and you keep holding on to it and don't reject it, it means you stay in Christ, you abide in Him, and this has been forsaken. This has been let go of. So, his love for God constrains him. He doesn't transgress the law anymore. He is restrained by the will of God, the command of God. And he no longer transgresses the law, therefore he no longer sins. This person can continue to live without sinning unless they are tempted and yield to that temptation to do what they did before, gratify their sensibilities. When a person becomes a Christian, they now start, for the first time, facing temptation to sin. Because prior to that, that's all they did. Now they are tempted to do that which they are not committed to. Indulge their sensibilities. Christians, when you become a Christian, now you enter a warfare against temptation to return to selfishness. But refusing to yield to that temptation, one abides in Christ and they continue not to transgress God's law. It's not a whole list of actions and acts that constitute this not sinning against God. What constitutes not sinning against God is abiding in His will, in His word, and having rejected the selfishness as an end. Is that understandable as a concept? Okay. When people try to get upset about, well, you say you cannot sin, and he abides in him does not sin, then that can't be true. They don't understand what the moral law requires. And they do not understand what sin is. I think sin is something that is in your nature. Those things which are under physical law, they say those are things that we are guilty of. Not true. Guilt lies in the state of the will. That's the transgression of law, lawlessness. What the will has transgressed. The will has transgressed the law that says I am to love God supremely. Nothing else can transgress that law. Your sensibilities can't transgress that law. Your intellect cannot transgress that law. Your conscience cannot transgress that law. Your body cannot transgress that law. Only your will can. And it's your will abiding in Christ in that state that is a state of not sinning against God. That's where it all lies. Any questions? Any application to yourself? Some thoughts that you need to develop? Understand. Develop your understanding of the law. We haven't even talked about love and the various aspects of that. But understand, the law addresses what you're committed to. If you're committed to that which is forbidden, you transgress the law and in a state of transgression. If you have consented to live according to His will and accept His mercy in place of your penalty on account of the blood of Jesus Christ, if you resolved your past sins through His grace and mercy and have consented to live according to His will, then you will cease from sinning. That is ceasing from sinning. You will not cease from sinning after that. That is ceasing from sinning. Teresa?
Well,